So this is a six-part series. Each of the six parts is fairly short, by Paul Kingsnorth. And it was done on Paul Kingsnorth as a writer, poet, and recovering environmentalist. Former deputy editor of The Ecologist magazine, he's the co-founder and director of the Dark Mountain Project, a network of writers and artists who have stopped believing the stories our civilization tells itself. And this was in ABC Environment, that's the Australian broadcasting company. This first part one is called Why Sustainability is Bad for the Environment. Sustainability does not mean defending the non-human world from human expansion. Instead, it has come to mean sustaining human civilization at the comfort level which the world's rich people feel is their right. For many years, I called myself an environmentalist. I don't use the word anymore, though the things that motivated me to do so are still important to me, perhaps more than they ever were. I became an environmentalist because of a strong emotional reaction to wild places and to natural beauty. From that reaction came a feeling, which became a series of thoughts, such things are precious for their own sake, that they are food for the human soul, that they need people to speak for them, and defend them from other people. Okay, let me say that again. They need people to speak for them to and to defend them from other people because they cannot speak our language and we have forgotten how to speak theirs. And because we are killing them to feed ourselves and we care about it sometimes, but we do it anyway because we are hungry or we have persuaded ourselves that we are. These are not very common sentiments within the mainstream of the green movement today. Today's environmentalism is as much a victim of the contemporary cult of utility as every other aspect of our lives, from science to education, the contemporary cult of utility. You won't hear many Greens today talking about their emotional reactions to the wild world. Instead, you'll hear them promoting something called sustainability. We hear this curious plastic word everywhere, but what does it mean? It does not mean what it ought to, defending the non-human world from the ever-expanding empire of industrial humanity. Instead, it has come to mean sustaining human civilization at the comfort level which the world's rich people, us, feel is their right, without destroying the natural capital, or the resource base, which is needed to do so. A strange confusion has come about. A movement which started out working to sustain nature at large in the face of human attacks upon it has ended up campaigning to sustain human industrial civilization instead. Let me give one example of this. If contemporary sustainability is about anything, it is about carbon and climate change. To listen to most environmentalists today, you would think that these were the only things in the world worth talking about. The business of sustainability has become the business of preventing carbon emissions. This reductive approach to the human environmental challenge leads to an obvious conclusion. If carbon is the problem, then zero carbon is the solution. Society needs to go about its business without spewing the stuff out. Build enough of the right kind of energy technologies quickly enough to generate the power we quote-unquote need without producing greenhouse gases, and there will be no need ever to turn the lights off, no need to ever slow down. To do this will require the large-scale harvesting of the planet's ambient energy, sunlight, wind, water power. This means that vast new conglomerations of human industry are going to appear in places where this energy is most abundant. Unfortunately, these places coincide with some of the world's wildest, most beautiful, and most untouched landscapes. The sort of places which environmentalism came into being to protect. And so the deserts, perhaps the landscape always most resilient to permanent human conquest, are to be colonized by enormous solar arrays, glass and steel and aluminum, the size of small countries. The mountains and the moors, the wild uplands, are to be staked out like vampires in the sun, their chest pierced with rows of 500-foot wind turbines and associated access roads, mast pylons, and wires. The open oceans, already swimming in our plastic refuse and emptying of marine life, will be home to enormous offshore turbine ranges and hundreds of wave machines strung around the coastline. The rivers are to see their estuaries severed and silted by industrial barrages. The croplands and even the rainforests, the richest habitats on this terrestrial earth, are already highly profitable sites for biofuel plantations designed to provide guilt-free car fuel to the motion-hungry masses. What this adds up to should be clear enough, yet many people who should know better choose not to see it. This is business as usual, the expansive, colonizing, progressive human narrative, shorn only of the carbon. It is the latest phase of our careless, self-absorbed, ambition-addled destruction of the wild, the unpolluted, and the non-human. It is the mass destruction of the world's remaining wild places in order to feed the human economy. And without any sense of irony, people are calling this environmentalism. Something has gone wrong here. We have lost sight of the trees amongst all the wood. Instead of changing how we live, we are talking about changing our technologies. But it's not enough, and it's not the point. In the next article in this series, I'll be looking at what modern environmentalism seems to have lost sight of. So the next one is titled, part two is titled, The Meaning of the Wild. Our society seems to be obsessed with the concept of wildness, but further from it than ever before. If we don't pay attention, we may lose our wilderness altogether. What is wild? It seems to be an increasingly common question. A slew of books have been published in the last few years about wild places, wild living, wild food, the end of the wild, redefining the wild, rediscovering the wild. As the industrial economy eats further and further into the world beyond the human bubble, something within us seems to respond, some alarm bells seem to ring. And as we lose more and more wilderness, we grow more and more fascinated with what we are losing. I could regale you here with a list of facts and statistics about that loss, which is real and ongoing and awful. I could tell you about the loss of forest cover, species, coral, large mammals, ice caps, but what would be the point? You have probably been presented with all of these facts before, and you have probably already made up your mind about them. Either you will agree with me that their loss is real and tragic, or you will claim that the facts in question are somehow bogus, because you don't share my worldview. Either way, there's probably nothing new I can tell you. This in itself is telling. The mass destruction of the natural world at the hands of one species, ours, has no precedent in the history of this planet as far as we know. Many scientists believe we are currently undergoing a mass extinction event the likes of which have not been seen for 65 million years. The last one killed off the dinosaurs and much else. This one is our fault. You would think that this would be a cause for unity, for all humans of all colors and stripes to come together, put aside their differences, and work to ensure that we do not destroy the rest of life on Earth as we go about our business. And yet, the opposite has happened. The constant battle between climate change campaigners and so-called climate deniers is only one example of this. More widely, the environmental movement itself is riven with arguments about how best to protect nature. Where I live in Britain, many of these arguments are focused around wind farms and other large-scale renewable technologies which, when employed on any scale, often destroy the very wild, the open landscapes which inspired many environmentalists in the first place. What we today call the environmental, or green movement, grew in the 1960s and 70s from an earlier, less politicized but arguably more grounded conservation movement. The conservation movement was less interested in energy technologies and climate justice, quote-unquote, than in a more old-fashioned and ostensibly simple goal, saving wildlife and preserving natural and wild places from human development. Today, though, something curious has happened. The language of the environmental movement barely mentions wildness in this older sense at all. Despite the popularity of those books, despite our sense that wildness is being lost, and despite what I think is a widespread human intuition that something is very wrong, that something is missing, this is not reflected in the language of mainstream environmentalism. That language, instead, is increasingly technocratic, cold, and data-obsessed. The talk is of parts per million of carbon, peer-reviewed papers, sustainable technologies, renewable supergrids, green growth, and the 15th conference of the parties. There are campaigns about the planet and the earth, but there is no specificity, no sign of any real felt attachment to any small part of the earth. What has happened? Where is religion in this process? Yes, Michael, I'm looking at you. The answer is that a number of forces have converged. One has been the near total takeover of environmentalism by the political left, a topic that I'll talk more about in a future article here. But there is something else too, something more basic but also sadder. Put simply, each new human generation has less and less contact with non-human life than the one before. Each generation brought up in a so-called developed country, quote-unquote, spends less and less time outdoors. Children spend more time in front of screens than playing in the fields. They are driven to school rather than walking. They live in towns or cities rather than the countryside. They have less and less knowledge of where food comes from, how farming works, what grows even in their back garden or the fields near their house. We are being sucked more rapidly than every year into an isolated techno-industrial bubble. Our machines get better all the time, but they can't compensate us for the loss of the green wildness we used to take for granted just outside the door. In the circumstances, is it any wonder that our environmentalists are part of this bubble too? An environmental movement whose foot soldiers spent much of their time in offices and cities writing reports or press statements is easy to lead astray. Why not industrialize a mountain for electricity? If you've never been there, what can this mean to you anyway? I don't blame environmentalists for this. We are all in the same boat, but the boat is sinking. It's time we jumped out and started to swim for it. So the next one, part three in this six-part series, is titled Seeing Our Planet as a Factory Floor. If we believe that the rest of nature is a resource for human use, then we will treat our planet simply as a factory floor. Even if we manage that factory sustainably, it will be a poor and depressing world. When you talk about nature, strange things happen in this culture. And by this culture, I mean the westernized post-Enlightenment world in which most reading this probably live. One of these strange things can be illustrated by quoting from a comment by Genfi, which appeared under the first article in the series, and which its writer liked so much that he or she repeated it almost verbatim under the second. Quote, "The notion of wilderness is a human construct. There is no such thing as wilderness, and most areas we see as wild have actually been managed actively by human populations for thousands of years. It's nice that you get a great feeling by being in the wild. Somehow, I don't think that should dictate anyone's policy on anything, particularly since whole indigenous peoples were slaughtered for you to get it." Unquote. This is an increasingly fashionable view, and it's one which fuels an offshoot of the green movement, which I've elsewhere called neo-environmentalism. It does a postmodern take on the non-human world with a dose of liberal guilt about the oppression of indigenous peoples, not much of which has happened in the English Lake District where I live, but never mind. While not entirely erroneous, it has the effect of producing the kind of intellectual carte blanche for developers. After all, if there's no such thing as wilderness or even nature, why should anything be off limits to development? Personally, I've found that an attitude which appreciates or even venerates wild, untamed places accords strongly with the worldview of every indigenous community I've ever spent time with, and offends most strongly those who confuse the progress of humanity with the progress of industrial society. I mention this because what is going on here is a battle between stories. All cultures are based on stories. We like to believe that we are primarily thinking beings, using our rational minds to take an objective, quote-unquote, look at the world around us. In reality, the way we see everything is emotionally loaded and culturally constructed. Our belief in the inevitability of progress, quote-unquote, our definitions of development and justice, our understanding of what science reveals or seems to reveal, our ethics and our moralities, all of these are stories with which we come to believe our facts. Towering over all of these is a single overarching story which dominates our way of seeing the world, the story of human centrality. Originally, it was a religious story. In the West, it stems from the Christian notion that God created the world for humans, who in turn were created in His image. In Genesis, God specifically instructs man to dominate, manage, and act as stewards to the rest of nature. On our journey through the Enlightenment and the scientific revolution, we have mostly dropped the belief in God, but we haven't dropped the belief that Homo sapiens, our name for our species tells us something about our stories, is the hub around which the world's wheel revolves. The worldview is often called anthropocentric, human-centered. It puts our own species at the pinnacle of nature's tree, and it sees the rest of the world through the lens of its needs and desires, needs or desires. Its most common political manifestation today is the often unquestioned assumptions that humans have a right, a duty, or simply a need to quell, tame, and manage the rest of life on Earth, to behave in the words of American thinker Stuart Brand, as gods. It seems to me that this way of seeing is at the root of our environmental crisis. It also seems to me that it is a way of seeing that is not challenged often enough, if at all, in the world of mainstream environmentalism. Michael, get the fuck on it. The reason for this is understandable. If you're working to change policies or get corporations to behave themselves, you're unlikely to impress them with this kind of talk. Yet this surely has to change. This way of seeing is at the root of our belief that the rest of nature is a resource for our use. If we can't start to see the non-human world as intrinsically valuable, if we can't start to see that the Earth itself as a living community of which we are only one part, we will continue to treat it simply as a factory floor. We may aim to manage that factory floor sustainably, or that factory sustainably, quote-unquote, but it will be a poor and depressing world we are building. What's the alternative? It's a worldview that many other cultures, human cultures particularly, though not exclusively, tribal cultures, have held in the past and some cases still do. It has been called ecocentrism. It sees humanity as part of a web rather than as the leader of the pack. The late environmental academic Stan Rowe explained it this way, quote, "To switch Western culture from its present track means finding a new and compelling belief system to redirect our way of living. It must be a vital outgrowth from our science-based culture. It seems to me that the only promising universal belief system is ecocentrism, defined as a value shift from Homo sapiens to planet Earth." A value shift, precisely. A shift to a different way of seeing, which is not, as it is sometimes misrepresented, anti-human, but rather sees humans in perspective and denies us our egotistical need to claim the high ground. In other words, a new story, or perhaps simply the return of a very old one. Part 4 in the 6-part series by Paul Kingsnorth, is titled Taking the Greens Out of the Left Wing. The environmental movement has become politically aligned with the left, but accommodation on either side of the traditional spectrum limits the ability to look beyond the needs of humans alone. And then he's got a visual image on the right. It says, the politics of the environment encompass a vast amount of things that humans rarely consider. Many years ago, I taught a class in environmental politics at a London college. I started the class by drawing a circle on the blackboard. This, I told the students, represents industrial society. Within this circle, I drew two smaller ones. One of them represented the political left, one the political right. Then I drew another circle, just outside the first one, but meeting it at the edges. This, I said, was where green politics was supposed to sit. It was not part of the conventional argument about how to divide up the spoils of the industrial process. Its purpose was to argue that the definition of progress itself was the problem to be solved, that industrial society, as currently constituted, was a threat not only to the individual freedom cherished by parts of the right and the social justice cherished by parts of the left, but also to the entire global ecosystem, what both sides referred to as the natural world, as if somehow humans were unnatural and apart from it, which both were frantically destroying in the name of that progress. In this sense, I said, green politics was more radical and much older than the teachings of either Marx or Hayek. In explaining this, I was outlining one of the founding concepts of the Green Movement, as it had begun to take political form in the 1970s, that from an ecocentric perspective, the similarities between left and right are greater than their differences. From an ecocentric perspective, similarities between the left and the right are greater than their differences. This argument is at the core of green thinking. It is a philosophy which sees humanity as part of the mesh of life, not as a separate entity which can control and direct something called nature with no consequences for itself. It stresses that what is often regarded as political radicalism is in fact a reordering of the same anthropocentric development paradigm, in which the fruits of the destruction of global ecosystems are simply distributed more fairly than before. Today, 40 years after green politics began to coalesce into a serious political force, the case has been spectacularly proven. But environmentalism is today widely considered a left-wing or progressive position. The result can be that the green politics ends up looking less like a radical change to industrial society and more like soft-focused socialism with a catalytic converter. From a pragmatic point of view, this is a problem because it confines the Greens to the overcrowded ghetto into which the radical left has been penned for decades without ever breaking out. Its confinement makes the Greens unappealing to those, which means most people, for whom that ghetto contains little or nothing of interest. But there is also a wider consideration. One of the original aims of green politics was to go beyond the left-right dichotomy, to speak up for the wider world, for the non-human world, for its own sake, because no other ideology would. An accommodation with the left undermines the founding ethos of radical green politics, ecocentrism. The left, though it likes to lay claim to the green mantle, has no interest in ecocentrism. By definition, it cannot have. For the point of the left is to struggle for social justice for human beings. The environment will always come as a poor second to the achievement of this historical mission. The common response to this is to claim, as many environmentalists do, that environmental justice and social justice go hand in hand, or even that you cannot have environmental justice without social justice. Both such claims make explicit the left-wing nature of mainstream green politics today, and there is a reason they are made. It's been noted that a certain type of nature-loving politics is often found on the far right, and it's also true that the early pre-green conservation movement often perpetrated injustices to humans whilst trying to protect nature. Understandably and rightly, intelligent Greens want to avoid association with this kind of thing. There is often a connection between poverty and social exclusion on the one hand and environmental degradation on the other. For example, toxic waste dumps, polluting factories, and the like have long been shown to impact much more heavily on the poor than the rich. Meanwhile, wealthy societies and individuals may have a better chance of adapting to climate change than poor ones. But there is also an obvious tension at the very heart of any claim that the environment is, at heart, an issue of human social justice. For a start, social justice is a contested term. Everyone has a view of what is just and unjust, and those views differ widely. More importantly, though, looking at it from a deep ecological perspective, it is impossible to get away from the fact that the interests of human beings, or at least the interests of human industrial society, will often conflict with the interests of the wider natural world. If that were not the case, we would not be now bogged down in the greatest ecological crisis in millions of years. Sometimes circles have to be squared and sides have to be taken. Sometimes the desires, sorry, the needs, of humans need to come second, not first. The Greens exist to make that case, but the Green Left rarely, if ever, does. More widely, the takeover of the Greens by the Reds has helped to torpedo some green causes. How have we gotten into a position where an issue like climate change, which is clearly in everyone's interest to work toward preventing or at least adapting to with minimum damage, has become so divisive? One reason is that environmentalism is perceived, often correctly, as a left-wing cause, and that climate change is seen by many as an excuse for lefty Greens to impose their real underlying political agenda. The paranoia present in that worldview, nevertheless, has a root in reality. The Greens are today, broadly, a faction of the left. My point is not that Greens should instead make an accommodation with the right. The point is that any such accommodation on either side of the traditional spectrum limits our vision and ability to look beyond the needs and desires of humans alone. We could do with taking some advice from the American poet Robinson Jeffers, quote, "We must uncenter our minds from ourselves. We must unhumanize our views a little." The fifth in this six-part series by Paul Kingsnorth is called Romance and Reason. Environmentalists who don't want to destroy trees because just that feels wrong are often dismissed as woolly and emotional. But what's so wrong with acknowledging our emotions? In 1798, William Wordsworth and Samuel Taylor Coleridge published Lyrical Ballads, a bomb thrown into the heart of the literary establishment. Ballads, though slow-selling at first, was to become a revolution in English poetry. It was to begin another revolution as well, for it was in the ballads that William Wordsworth's great green vision was first on display, though it has since been packaged as daffodil-themed literary nostalgia, at the very time when Wordsworth had to say, what Wordsworth had to say was seen as very much more edgy and even dangerous, exemplified by this verse from The Tables Turned, quote, "One impulse from a vernal wood may teach you more of man, of moral evil and of good, than all the sages can." What became known as the Romantic worldview is often airily dismissed today by the kind of people who imagine they are rational, objective grown-ups with no time for wandering o'er the hills, writing airy verse about shepherds. But the Romantics were not seen this way in their day. They were seen as they intended to be seen, as political radicals. In The Tables Turned, as in his later writings as a young man, Wordsworth was laying down an explicit challenge to the Enlightenment legacy of which he, as a keen supporter of the French Revolution, was himself a product. The young Wordsworth talked unashamedly of nature, quote-unquote, as a living entity. He saw our meddling intellect as part of the dilemma of being human. The thing which distanced us from nature and allowed us to objectify it, or, as he put it in the same poem, to, quote, "murder to dissect," unquote. He blasted both human science and human art as being too distant from the real world of mud, grass, and sky to be able to see that that world as it really was. Wordsworth lived during the first age of unchecked industrialization. The year of his death, 1850, was also the year in which Britain's urban population exceeded its rural population for the very first time. He could see what was coming, and his solution was a re-engagement of the human senses with the non-human world. What does this have to do with today's environmentalism? Many Greens would probably hurriedly insist that the answer is nothing at all. Today's environmental debate is technocratic, pseudoscientific, data-centered, entirely focused on quote-unquote realistic, quote-unquote solutions to a problem which has never been well-defined. Politicians, business people, and professional sustainability junkies get on with the somber business of greening modern life, and the undertone is clear. We are serious people now, and environmentalism is a serious business. Ecosystem collapse threatens our economic competitiveness. There's no time for romance. We're not interested in nature, capital N, which is, in any case, a fiction invented by dead white guys. The only impulse from a vernal wood which we can realistically afford to think about is one which provides zero carbon electricity for our ever-growing economies. The technocratic takeover of modern environmentalism is virtually complete now, and those who do not buy into it are left with nowhere to turn but the fringes, well-meaning hippie eco-settlements, or the self-defeating identity politics of protest. Managerial environmentalism is intended to be a matter of the head and not the heart. The dictatorship of reason, which has permeated every aspect of modern society, from education to the arts, has environmentalism firmly in its grip as well. As such, however, it has bypassed another of the main drivers of the original green movement, the need to reconnect emotionally, intuitively, and sensually with the real world beyond the cities and the motorway junctions. It is tempting at this point to set up emotion in opposition to reason and to demand more of the former and less of the latter in the green debate. Certainly modern greens could do with being more open and honest about what really moves them, most of them in the first place. Most green campaigners are passionate about nature for reasons that they are unable to put into words, but that inability does not invalidate the feelings that motivate their work. The fact that something cannot be easily defined on a page or in a data set does not mean it is not real. It is more likely to mean it is complex, nuanced, and not easy to simplify, which also means it is likely to be deep, old, and meaningful. But beyond this, the temptation to set up emotion in opposition to reason, or subjective as opposed to objective experience, is to play the game of the enemy. The kind of person who dismisses any felt human reaction to the natural world as romantic often likes to think of themselves as a rational respecter of measurable science rather than a waffler dealing in unquantifiable superstition. But what neuroscience has been revealing over the last 15 years is that the old Cartesian environmental enlightenment myth of a disembodied rational mind, which works best when unclouded by emotion, was never a reality. On the contrary, in fact, our minds are embodied, and our rational and emotional reactions are two sides of the same coin. They are even products of the same areas of the brain, and one cannot function without the other. What this is likely to mean is that if we get a strong emotional reaction to, say, walking in an ancient forest or seeing it destroyed for lumber, there's likely to be a good reason for it. We may or may not be able to lay it out on a spreadsheet, but it is valid as anything that we can, and maybe it is valid as anything that we can, and maybe more so. Or, to put it another way, being a romantic, quote unquote, is nothing to be ashamed of. Quite the opposite. It is the expression of a genuine, felt attachment to non-human nature, something which is as old as our species, and something without which we would become little better than machines. This reality can't be peer-reviewed by the kind of people who think it can't be. If it can't be measured, it isn't real. But that doesn't make it any less of a necessity for a good human life. And then the sixth of this six-part series is titled The Myth of Technological Salvation. Humanity is obsessed with progress, which usually means building better machines to solve our problems. What if this thinking was in fact making the problems worse? And then there's a picture, a terrifying picture of a computer hand or like a machine hand holding the whole earth. It says, if you believe in the tale of the triumph of progress, then you could believe that the machines will eventually save us from ourselves. What do you do after you stop pretending? This was the question, or one of the questions, with which we launched the Dark Mountain Project in 2009. What do you do after you stop pretending? We were, still are, a network of writers, artists, thinkers, and doers who had become disillusioned with our own work to change or save, quote-unquote, the world, and who wanted to question more deeply the stories that underpinned our attempts to do so. Many of us had come through environmental activism and had also become disillusioned or even despairing about our ability to make the necessary changes in time. On every metric, from population growth to resource consumption, deforestation to fisheries exploitation, atmospheric CO2 concentration to the rise in GDP, the lines on the graphs have careened almost vertically upward since the 1950s and show no sign of stopping, however many green campaigns are launched. The root cause of all these trends is the same: a rapacious human economy which shows no interest whatsoever in changing its direction of travel. Indeed, probably could not do so even if all its leaders suddenly had a change of heart. Such is its momentum now. It seems to me these days that these facts are giving us a simple, uncontroversial message. Our civilization is going to hit the buffers very hard in the not-too-distant future, and then it's going to fall apart. Quite how or when this will happen, I couldn't begin to say, but the alternative, a mass change of hearts and minds, seems more preposterous still. Yet very few of us seem interested in looking honestly at the message this reality is screaming at us. The obvious question, why not, can be puzzling if you assume, as both Marxists and neoliberals tend to, that humans are sensible creatures who assess evidence and then act in their own rational self-interest. The reality seems to be rather more complex. Man is a prejudiced, confused, emotional animal who, in the famous words of Paul Simon, hears what he wants to hear and disregards the rest. There is also a deeper problem. The stories we tell ourselves about who we are prevent us from believing what actually appears to be going on. Every civilization has its foundational myth, and ours is the myth of progress. Enlightenment rationalism grafted its own vision of the perfectibility of humanity through science and the intellect onto Western Christianity's utopian rootstock. Oh, that's an interesting metaphor. Enlightenment rationalism grafted its own vision of the perfectibility of humanity through science and the intellect onto Western Christianity's utopian rootstock, and we have all eaten of the strange fruit that resulted. We believe, we have to believe, that everything will keep getting better for us. What does getting better look like in this culture? Usually it looks like solving every problem that comes our way with new technology. Given Western man a job of work to do, wrote George Orwell in the 1930s, and he will immediately set about inventing a machine to do it for him. Nothing has changed since then. We are still wedded to a vision of the future as an upgraded version of the current experience. Present 2.0. We still believe in progress, which we lazily define as the inevitable continuation of Western techno-industrialism. Climate change? Overpopulation? The mass destruction of ecosystems? A collapsing economic model? No worries, the machines will come to our rescue. It is this attitude that leads the climate deniers to do what they do. But it is also this attitude that leads environmentalists to adopt their quasi-religious attitude to renewable energy, in which the destruction of a mountain by a turbine range is simply the price we have to pay for our inevitable salvation by machine. The mainstream green movement has bought completely into the myth of techno-progress and has bet its house on creating a green economy and a sustainable society, which, when examined, turns out to be much like the world we have now, only with more trees, a mysteriously stable climate, and wind farms instead of coal. It looks to me like a fantasy. It was Einstein who said, famously, that problems are not solved by the same mindsets that created them. We are not going to get ourselves out of the trap that this civilization has flung the earth into by accelerating deeper into the technosphere and discarding only the carbon. Something else has to give. I'd suggest that the myth of green progress may be one of the first victims.